This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We are slated to start with Charlotte Alter. Her book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. There are now 26 millennials in Congress. That's a five-fold increase in the 2018 midterms alone. We'll talk about that. Also, Shauna Banks Daniel, the councilwoman from East Baton Rouge Parish, on what's going on in an election year. The mayor is seeking re-election, and of course, the council has much business to do, and there are racial divisions in our community. Nothing new, and the latest about a judge admitting to racial slurs. We'll talk about this and more, including tire shredding, which amazingly is a big issue. And we'll hear from Donnie Rose, the celebrated poet, Baton Rougean. He's got a major appearance coming this week at the Manship Theater, the American Audit. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support comes from Brian Lowe Financial. And our number is 877-217-5757. You can reach us by email, talk@talklouisiana.org. Alondra, can you pull up our guest here, because I'm having some challenges in this studio getting her on the air. But this is Charlotte Alter, who is a fabulous young writer. Her book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. We've had her father, Jonathan Alter, on this show many times. And Charlotte has come forward with a book about millennials, something she knows. Over the last 3 years, she's crisscrossed the country speaking with millennial leaders who are trying to rebuild the country from the ground up. The book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For, How a New Generation of Leaders Will Transform America. And good morning, Charlotte.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, tell us about millennials and some of the perceptions and maybe misperceptions people have about your generation.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on the show. So basically, you know, the book traces the lived experiences of many of the young leaders who are just.
Okay. Can you pull
Sorry,
it up?
Uh-oh.
Go ahead.
Uh-oh, sorry. I'm hearing some feedback. I can't tell if you can hear me or not. But anyway, so the book traces the lived experiences of 10 young leaders who are just now stepping into political power. So I cover Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is the congresswoman from New York, as well as Republicans like Dan Crenshaw, who's a GOP congressman from Houston, and Elise Stefanik, who is from upstate New York. And the book kind of traces how the events of the last 20 years, starting at 9/11, going through the wars that followed, and then the financial crisis, the rise of Barack Obama, and then the rise of Donald Trump, have really shaped the way this generation thinks about politics in a way that's very different from their parents.
Well, it's a book that, of course, features some of the people that we are following closely. And there is a millennial running for president of the United States, the mayor, former mayor of South Bend, Pete Buttigieg, born in 1982. He's 37 years old. He's the first gay person to be a major thrust in the campaign for president of the United States. What about his role as a trailblazer, independent of whether or not he's going to win? He will be, I'm sure, a major player a century from now when people view what happened in 2020.
Yeah, so he's somebody that's pretty interesting, because when I first met him, I first started interviewing him for this book in 2017 for a story I did about millennial mayors. And when I met him, he had just gotten his dog, named Truman. And I said, "Why did you name your dog Truman?" And he said, "Well, Harry Truman said that if you want a friend in Washington, you should get a dog." And I said, "Well, you live in South Bend, Mayor Pete, so what's that about?" and so he, you know, he's somebody who, in a lot of ways, so much of what makes him such a compelling and strong political candidate can also be tied to the fact that not only he's a gay American, but also that he was in the closet for 33 years of his life. I mean, Pete Buttigieg is unbelievably disciplined. He's unbelievably on message. He's unbelievably self-possessed and composed and very in control of how he's presenting himself. And he also is somebody who has a lot of empathy and a lot of belief in people's capacity to change. And I think that that is really the root of his presidential campaign. That's his fundamental message, is that he's preaching a form of forgiveness. A lot of what Buttigieg is saying in his speeches is, listen, if you are a what he calls future former Republican, if you're somebody who voted for Trump and have misgivings about that, come on back. We'll welcome you back to the Democratic Party. And I think a lot of that can actually be linked to the fact that he grew up in the closet in a conservative Midwestern community. He served in the military when he was in the closet. He had a lot of friends and people he knew in his life who would say things about gay people and make homophobic comments and, you know, had views that needed to evolve. And rather than just kind of dismiss them out of hand, he was able to sort of bring people along and had a faith in people's ability to grow and change their minds. And that's one thing that I think makes him really compelling as a candidate.
The book is The Ones We've Been Waiting for a national correspondent for Time, Charlotte Alter, who I'm sure will have a long and distinguished career in journalism, and some of these millennials, 26 now in Congress, by the way, will be ruling the land in short order. And there will be a time when I'm sure millennials represent a majority in both houses of Congress. And even as famous as Pete Buttigieg has become, he's probably not as well known in many places as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the representative of New York's 14th District. It's an amazing story of her rise to prominence, isn't it? 29 years old.
Yeah.
An amazing story.
I think she might have recently turned 30, but yes, I mean, she is somebody who went from being a bartender and an activist to being one of the most famous political figures in America when she unseated Joe Crowley in New York's 14th District. She's somebody who's really interesting because she is basically an activist who happens to be a member of Congress. You know, she's an activist with a congressional pin. So her theory of change is less about, let's write this perfect law and get people on board and get it passed and get it through the Senate. Her theory of change is much more about, let's change the conversation, let's change the parameters of debate, let's open people's minds to different versions of this possibility, and then the laws will follow. Which is a kind of a controversial way to approach politics, but one that so far has been working for her.
How do you think millennials will affect this election, the 2020 election, Charlotte?
So, you know, I think that no matter which way you cut it, this is a generational election. On the one hand, you have the presumptive front runner, who is Bernie Sanders, who is the front runner because of his support with young people. You have basically second in roughly second place. You have Pete Buttigieg, who's the first millennial presidential candidate, as you mentioned. And you also have, you know, all of these candidates are going to be going up against a president who is the oldest first-term president, elected overwhelmingly by voters over 65, mostly white voters, and who surrounds himself with people who were born in the early half of the 20th century. Meanwhile, 16 million people will have turned 18 in between 2016 and 2020. So, in a lot of ways, this election is shaping up to be a showdown between the older, mostly white conservatives who still favor Donald Trump and the younger, multiracial coalition of young progressives who are now very obviously seem to be lining up behind Bernie Sanders. And I have no idea, if I knew which way that was going to go, I would be a very rich woman. But I do think that this election very well may break down along generational lines.
Well, it's a case in which you just said that millennials are largely supportive of Bernie Sanders, who on the 8th of September will turn 79 years old, meaning he's 5 years older. He's 5 years older than President Trump. Pete Buttigieg is 41 years younger than he. Why isn't Buttigieg the overwhelming favorite among millennials? After all, he is one of them, and it appears that more millennials are going for Sanders, the oldest guy running. How's this happening?
So I think there's two things at play here. One is that in a lot of ways, Pete Buttigieg, to borrow a line from Michael Kinsley, seems like an old person's idea of what a young person should be. So Pete Buttigieg is actually very popular with baby boomers because a lot of them look to him and they think, oh, this guy reminds me of my son. He reminds me of my grandson. He's very appealing in that way. But also, the other part of this is that older voters in particular, I've noticed in my reporting for this book and also on this election, seem to have more discomfort with the age question when it comes to Bernie Sanders, partly because they understand what age actually means. So people in their late 50s or their 60s, they might feel like they are maybe themselves slowing down a little bit. They are forgetting things here and there. They're having trouble running after their grandkids. They think to themselves, how could somebody 15 years older than me take on the most difficult job on the planet when I feel like I'm kind of ready to retire and take a little bit of a step back? And so they are much more primed to be looking at somebody younger like Pete Buttigieg. Meanwhile, for many young progressives, particularly the ones who are behind Sanders, they are really angry. And one reason that they don't get behind somebody like Pete Buttigieg is that they reject this kind of conciliatory, let's all get along type of politics that Pete Buttigieg is in some ways mimicking Obama on this particular style. They feel dispossessed. They feel like they've been robbed of the sense of security that their parents and grandparents had in this country. They have 34% less wealth than.
Okay, we do have to roll, but the book is The Ones We've Been Waiting For from the fabulous Charlotte Alter, and we'll be back after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Alondra Villarreal is producing, and in studio is Shauna Banks, councilwoman, who is not a shrinking violet. She'll take on most any topic. So if you'd like to call again, 877-217-5757, and you can send an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Good morning, Councilwoman.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you for having me.
And what does your shirt say?
Black don't crack.
Okay. On that note, as we know, race is an issue, maybe the issue in our world and in our community, a huge one. And front page of The Advocate today, judge admits to racial slurs in TV interview, woman under fire over relationship with ex-chief deputy. This story, talk about having legs. It seems like it's been front page for a long time. Mm-hmm. And the judge is Jesse LeBlanc. What do you think? Should she go, or is this something that she's apologized for and we can move on down the line? What do you think?
Well, I think as it relates to the racial slur, certainly we accept her apology. Now she should resign. It's not just a racial slur. It's all the character bad moves she's making as it relates to having this affair. When you go before a judge, you're thinking this judge has integrity, they have character, they have good decision-making skills, they have wisdom. And on all fronts, anyone going before Judge LeBlanc will doubt those things and will possibly put all cases in jeopardy.
Well, last Friday, we had a robust discussion about the case involving the Zachary school teacher who's alleged to have abused a 14-year-old African-American student. She is white. There is a racial component, but also, of course, the biggest component is the fact that this was an adult teacher taking advantage, statutory rape, if you will, if it's true, of a student. And the community is at odds over whether proper action is taken. That's not in your district. I believe that's Trey Welch.
Absolutely.
But I know you're following the story. What do you think of that one?
Well, I had years as a child abuse investigator, so I'm well-versed as it relates to sexual abuse. And this is sexual abuse. I think the racial component has to do with the fact that it appeared that those that lead the principal, superintendent, law enforcement tried to cover up this lady's action. The Bankses, my relatives, are originally from the city of Zachary, And I had cousins who said, as well as in December, there were jokes around the school regarding who will get gifts from this teacher and who will be giving gifts. So this was knowledge, but, you know, Zachary wants to have a squeaky, clean experience and want people to think everything is so wonderful, so they tried to hide this. So for me, sexual abuse and even some of the media reports where they said an affair or consensual sex, those are not terms that you would use with a 15-year-old and a 34-year-old. This is statutory rape. It is child abuse. This child, even at one point, he may have thought that this was an added notch on his buckle. There are quite a few psychological issues that will occur. And this is the kind of situation when we see not only him as a possible sexual abuser, but all kind of problems that he can have.
877-217-5757 and talk at talklouisiana.org. And already we have some people asking about this tire shredder program. This also had a racial component to it. Where is it now?
Well, thanks to Mayor Sharon Weston Broom, she offered the landfill that the city owns and waste management manages to place the tire shredder. I think there were a lot of misnomers as it relates to the tire shredder. The tire shredder had nothing to do with the city of Baton Rouge, nothing to do with blight. And those were some of the nothing to do with 311 calls. It is actually a CDC grant where they were looking to viruses for mosquitoes. But you could also have gotten cameras with this, not just a tire shredder. There are a lot. It could have been based on education for the community. The city of the grant did not come to the city of Baton Rouge. It came to the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals, which partnered with MARC. And from there on, there were a lot of manipulations in our community from there on.
Well, as I mentioned, race is an issue in just about everything. And a listener asks, how much was race a factor in the St. George movement?
Well, the St. George movement, I mean, there are some similarities as it relates to the St. George movement to that the people in Scotlandville in the 70s also were concerned about when they tried to be an independent city. So there are a lot of similarities that are mirrored. The underlying current as it relates to St. George is where people think that it's to make sure that the city is not, if for lack of a better term, have an increased representation of African Americans that live, work, play in that area. I don't know that. I've never spoken with those that are proponents of St. George. All I know is that I think it will be a high cost for those that live in St. George. And I think we are, without being cliche, is better together.
Well, it looks like it's going to be a protracted court fight.
Mm-hmm.
The vote was close, but the people within those boundaries, the boundary of St. George, which, of course, was carefully configured by the organizers,
yes,
they admitted that it was to get the vote positively,
mm-hmm,
eliminating some areas that are right on the, well, they would have been in the old area that was originally thought about. But nonetheless, why didn't the whole city get a chance to vote, the whole parish? That is a question many have. Why do you think that did not happen?
I really don't know. I think the entire city should have had an opportunity to vote because we will all be impacted as it relates to the services that the entire city of Baton Rouge is responsible for. Whenever you pull out any particular area, the cost factor will increase on the remaining. And so that's why all of us are affected. I think the people that are would be a city of St. George, you know, their services are going to be through the roof. But I also think those that are of us that are left behind will have to in some way mitigate that cost. You know, as you know, whether it's fire service, waste management, collections, schools, any public service service that we have, there is going to be a high cost and a great impact.
All right. This is an election year. you'll be running?
I will be running for my last term.
Yeah, you're term limited, 3 terms, but you have one more that you can win. And
yes.
you're running, I think, 12, 16, 20. So
yes, sir.
This is it. You won, it's hard to believe, 8 years ago. My goodness.
I know.
2 full terms. But the mayor is running for reelection.
Yes.
And it looks like she'll have some company on the ballot. How do you see the mayor's race?
I hope that the mayor will have an opportunity to be reelected just based on those that are either rumored or have confirmed running. I haven't seen anyone that have stated that they have any intentions that would be a better mayor as it relates to compromising, mm-hmm. making sure that there is inclusion from one end of the parish to the other. There are sometimes I have not agreed with the mayor as it relates to areas like the Bridge Center and some other area that I can't remember now. But as it relates to the people and making sure that the people of the city parish needs are being met and heard, I think she's done a phenomenal job.
When you say the Bridge Center, what did you find fault with her on that front?
I believe that the Bridge Center should have been an RFP. I think that for me, anytime BRAF is in any way involved, I think there's going to be an issue. So looking at the way the Bridge Center, which is allegedly following the San Antonio model, they're miles and hundreds of degrees apart.
877-217-5757. Shauna Banks is with us. Later we'll hear from the fabulous poet Donnie Rose, but there is an opportunity to talk with the councilwoman about what's going on in our community, and as we know, we've got some challenges. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Shauna Banks, Councilwoman, East Baton Rouge Parish, finishing her second term, running for re-election this year. It's an election year. I gather, based on your remarks, you're supporting the mayor for her re-election
yes.
quest. But it looks like Tara Wicker might run.
Right.
I think certainly there will be a candidate or two on the Republican side of the ledger. And Matt Watson, some of your colleagues are looking at it closely.
That's true.
So you think it'll be a tough race for the mayor?
I don't know. If I had my wish, I would not want any of my current colleagues to be the mayor, president of Baton Rouge. I don't know what it's going to look like. We really won't know until July 15 when we qualify. But just looking at the landscape of as I indicated, those that have confirmed and even the rumored with my two colleagues, neither of them, I think, would be beneficial to the city parish of Baton Rouge.
Now, as I mentioned, you're not a shrinking violet. You take positions. You speak your mind. And after all, you are a council person. So I think that's in your interest and the community's interest that you express your opinions. But sometimes those opinions come with people who take shots at you. And some of these bloggers online are people who can't bench press their weight.
Sure.
One of them said that you were lower than pond scum. And, how do you react? You're laughing now, but first time you saw that, if you saw it, what was your reaction?
I literally never, ever see any of that. I never see it. I don't read, whatever. I never see it.
But why do you think... for example, it was on the Denise Amoroso thing in her succession,
sure.
which that was a legitimate issue.
Right.
And because you voted the way this individual thought you shouldn't, mm-hmm. He says you're lower than pond scum.
So as it relates to the issue where we had a vacancy after the death of Buddy Amoroso, the issue had nothing to do with Denise Amoroso. For 3 years back when Ronnie Edwards and Denise Marcel became state legislators, I had an issue where the vacating council member would choose their successor, I believe, in democracy,
mm-hmm.
and that when there's a vacancy, just as it is with a board and commission, anyone that meets the requirement of that area should be able to apply for the position online and be vetted properly. it was, you know, sheer just drama, you know, making it about Denise Amorosa. And those were some of the things that, because we are not well-read, we don't listen a lot of times. And eventually, you know, this year I did was successful in making sure that those agenda changes were made. So that's why you saw a smooth succession for the District 12 vacancy. And, you know, I think it was even more harmful that my colleagues who knew it had nothing to do with Denise Amorosa, in my opinion, manipulated the entire process. For me, if I were Denise Amorosa, I wouldn't need friends like that during one of the most horrific times of my life. I wouldn't want someone to make me be the scapegoat so that they can get another Republican seat.
And to her credit, she ran and won. So
yes.
She is a duly elected member of the Metro Council. And
she's an awesome person.
I suspect the two of you get along well. You're both
As I indicated, it was never about Denise Amorosa. I know as time went on, she probably realized that. We're both educators. Mm-hmm. So a lot of our talk is, when is our next spring break or something?
But Tara Wicker took some heat, I think unjustly, but she voted the way she thought was right, but it was different than you, and it was the deciding vote.
Sure. So we had no problem with... I personally had no problems with Tara Wicker's vote. I think that we are elected to represent the people, and her constituents came out in round numbers asking her to vote as they wanted. But again, with Tara Wicker, the problem that we as council members had that were on the opposing is that Tara Wicker did not tell the truth about things that happened.
She didn't.
No, we had meetings with Councilwoman Wicker, and we talked about planning the vote. How should it go? Tara Wicker sat in the meeting, and at the end of the meeting, she went to the media and gave out what it is that the conversation was about. She indicated that she had spoken with Denise Amorosa at Buddy's funeral. Denise Amorosa said that wasn't true. She went through the whole meeting with us, never indicated such. And so it was that kind of thing. It wasn't her vote. It's the fact that she does not tell the truth.
Oh, my.
And so that is the issue.
Sounds like you have some hard feelings.
No, I have no hard feelings. And we have to realize that when you speak truth, it has nothing to do with like, dislike. Hard feelings,
I don't mean to interrupt, but this is somewhat like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. Let's call it what it is. You're calling her a liar.
Well, she did lie in that case. It's the truth. I'm not just saying it with me. There were four other people in the room who may or may not choose to speak on the topic. But those are the things that happen, and that's all I can say is that's what happened.
Okay, well, hopefully we'll have Councilwoman Wicker.
Well, I'm sure she's going to say he did, but I mean,
now,
I'll stand before Jesus, who she talks about a lot, and I will say these same things.
Now, a listener writes that Councilwoman Wicker is likely to run against Sharon Westenbroom. Mm-hmm. This is Holly in the Garden District with... Okay. With the support, I haven't heard this before, and of course this is only speculative, with the support of Lane Grigsby, is that correct?
That is what we hear. That is the rumor mill indicates that Councilwoman Wicker has spoken with Lane Grigsby, and he has blessed her. If he's the kingmaker,
he'll be the queenmaker.
She will be the queenmaker. You know, that I could see that happening based on my 8 years on the council, the way Councilwoman Wicker has orchestrated the votes oftentimes with not only the Republicans, but those that are in business and industry. I think we would not equal where we were with former Mayor Holden, that we would be in a worse position than we did.
How do you compare the performance of Mayor Holden with that of Mayor Broom?
I think Mayor Holden, first of all, is a master, you know, as it relates to politics and getting things done. I think the last 4 years is when it was very obvious to many of us that he had no intention on helping the northern part of the parish, particularly Scotlandville, where he lived and resided. So I think, you know, the first year we were like, he has to do what he has to do. The second year, gave him a little mm-hmm. more. But year three, it was all out anger and feeling that he left us very much behind.
Now, this parish has become a Democratic stronghold. John Bel Edwards carried East Baton Rouge, and that includes St. George and Zachary and Central. Carried it by more than 50,000 votes. He got 68% of the votes in this parish when he ran against David Bruce Vitter. But on the council, and by the way, Obama carried East Baton Rouge mm-hmm. twice. Hillary Clinton won in East Baton Rouge Parish. Foster Campbell won in East Baton Rouge Parish. He beat John Kennedy here. Mary Landrieu beat homeboy Bill Cassidy here. But yet the council is majority conservative Republican. Why is that the case?
Well, I think for the most part, you have to look at the demographics. I think when we come up with the next census, we need to look at how they are drawn. For instance, when I ran in 2012, it was the beginning of the new census, and I lost part of Scotlandville, which was the Banks community. However, I gained part of Central, Hooper Road, which was Scott Wilson. So it's very hard to orchestrate those kind of numbers, but I do think we need to look at the numbers. I think that, you know, when we look at the new election, there's a very good chance that we can have a 6 or even 7-5 with 12 and Council 1. District 1.
And crime continues to be a major issue. How is that being addressed? Is it being addressed effectively?
Crime, and now we're seeing younger and younger people. I work for East Baton Rouge Parish, and many of the kids that I deal with have some history with crime, based the school that I particularly work at. And crime really has to do with a lack of economic development. I know people don't like us hearing that, but if you think about the way the African-American communities was, they were two-parent homes. They were working class. There were opportunities where you saw people in your neighbor that were doing well, had families. Mm-hmm. It's hard for a lot of us, and a lot of times people think it's being judgmental. But the data says that if you go to school and get a high school diploma plus some extra either extra work training or college, get married, buy a house, have children, in that order, you have 70% chance of being successful. And we just really have to go back to those basics.
Okay. Will we ever have a tolerance resolution or tolerance law? Or is that something that is going to continue to be a no-go?
Not with this current council. I go back and forth with the tolerance, not because I have any issues with denying anyone rights. I just am. I'm a 60s baby, and I think sexuality is a private matter. I'm old school like that. I think none of us really know what someone's sexuality is unless we are that individual. And I just think.
But should they be allowed to discriminate if somebody finds
not.
Out you're well? Then,
absolutely
well,
not.
Then is a law necessary?
As I said, on the surface, I'm all for them not being discriminated. So I just need. I'm a continuously okay. working on that.
We'll be back and have a few more minutes with Shauna Banks and hear from Donnie Rose after this message. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Yolanda Villarreal is producing, and if you'd like to get under the wire in our next couple of minutes with Shauna Banks, 877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org. And Katie's following up about the November election, by the way, which will not only include the mayor's race and council races, but also there will be U.S. Senator William Morgan Cassidy on the ballot, congressional races, and the big enchilada, the President of the United States, all on the same ballot come November. And Katie wants to know if this is just talk, or is there something real about this unusual union between staunch Republican Lane Grigsby and Democratic Councilwoman Tara Wicker, who hopefully we will have on this show. Where did you hear this? Is this just talk?
It's just talk. You know, I haven't confirmed anything with either Councilwoman Wicker or Lane Grisby, but they are, it is, I do have Republican friends, whether people believe it or not. If you recall, it was Republicans that helped me with the Baton Rouge Zoo, getting that over the hump. So,
you won that battle too.
I did. Thank you. Thank you, Lord. But that is the conversation that I'm hearing from Republicans.
And Lane Grigsby's a smart man, and he knows that this parish is now blue.
Yes.
So he might choose a blue candidate in hopes that that candidate would forward the agenda that he supports. And
absolutely.
That's just good
politics. That's
politics. Nothing wrong with that at
absolutely.
All. Nothing wrong.
Absolutely.
But it would be an unusual coupling.
Yes.
Thank you, Shauna.
But Lane Grisby is impartial as it relates to us. He's supported me for the last two races. I don't know if I can get third one. Yes.
He has.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll see what happens.
Yes.
The Queen Maker, Lane
yes.
Grigsby, right? 877-217-5757 as we move to the fabulous Donnie Rose, one of the best poets in America, and he will be on stage Friday at the Manship Theater. The American Audit, a multi-spoken word poetry project by this man, Donnie Rose, who is an educator and a Kennedy Center citizen artist, chronicling 400 years of Black American life. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to have you back, as always.
Absolutely.
And this is something I know you hold near and dear. You're trying to get a lot of school kids to.
Yeah, we've actually confirmed a few school shows. We have one the morning of Friday, February 28th. We also have one on March 2nd. So the response has been pretty astounding from local schools.
Well, you have been in this game a long time. You've been before a lot of audiences, but I'm sure you're always pleased to do something in your hometown, and the Manship Theater is quite a venue.
Yeah, we actually sold out the general public show as of 2 days ago.
Yeah.
So we'll be in the Hartley Vay Studio Theater, which is one of their black boxes. But
next door, yeah.
Yeah, there's absolutely no more seats left. And I am.
So you're not here trying to get people to come, but you're probably telling them, look, if you want to come,
right.
There's next time.
Yeah, I'm here to kind of talk about the merit of the show. But I do want to say before we move further that I'm immensely appreciative of the Baton Rouge community for buying tickets and for selling it out. And a lot of my friends text me and let me know that they purchased tickets. So it's going to be a good time.
400 years of African American life in this country. It's been an amazing odyssey, and of course some great challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what the American Audit does, it's an extended metaphor in which America is a business being hypothetically audited by Black Americans 400 years post Jamestown. And the reason why I decided to go with that metaphor was hearkening back to the idea that the original reason that African Americans were brought over, or Africans were brought over, was for the purpose of capitalism, for the purpose of business, for the purpose of economy. And so for me, the idea was, what better way to kind of look at assessing this 400-year mark than through some sort of economic metaphoric lens? So that's how I came up with the American Audit.
You have been on the show a few times. It's been a year or so, but your odyssey as a poet, how did it start?
21 years ago at Southern University. I was a student, and I was always into creative writing, and I found that there was an open mic on the campus, and I just kind of started going to the campus open mic, and the identity just kind of formed from there. There were a lot of things that I was not in school. I was not an athlete. I was not a band member. I was not a Greek. I was not a lot of different things. And so spoken word in the open mic allowed me to find some degree of community. From there, I went on to competing at poetry slams around the country. From there, I went on to teaching creative writing. And so it's just been a continuous evolution up to where we are now.
And you obviously enjoy what you do.
Yeah, it's not the worst. I enjoy the idea of expression, the idea of pushing creative boundaries. I especially enjoy the idea of passing that knowledge along to young people, because when I was a kid in high school writing, raps and writing poems, there was not a structured situation for me to be able to express myself. And so being able to be a facilitator of youth open mics and teaching young people, that has just been me being able to pay forward what the genre has done for me.
in this Twitter universe and people living their lives on their phones, how is poetry evolving? Has it been a good thing or is it a bad thing as far as the new technology?
Poetry is actually at one of its most popular places right now. And there's always this kind of recurring conversation about, is poetry dead? But modern poetry is actually thriving a whole lot, particularly in the digital and social media era, because there's such available access, right? And so there are poets on Twitter and on Instagram that have thousands upon thousands of followers that may, you know, put small poems on their social media, and it's just easier to engage. And so I think that, you know, social media is a new form of literary text for a lot of people. And so many young people and older people are able to access modern day poetry by way of social media.
Well, these young people that you're instructing, and you've done this for a while, how are they as far as the generation? We talked about millennials opening the show. These are people who are younger than millennials.
Generation Z.
Yeah, Generation Z, right? Mm-hmm. So how are they?
They are amazing. I think that what is happening right now, particularly when you talk about the creative arts and in poetry with reference to the Generation Z generation, is that you have such this large push of people moving to be centered. And so at our youth open mics, you can hear from a variety of different type of identities of young people. They are all pushing to have their identity centered. And so it's a beautiful time because, you know, the poetry that we came up on was essentially that of deceased white men. And so now you have a wide variety of voices, be it Black, Latino, Asian, queer, trans. There's just a great multitude mm-hmm. of voices that are being moved to center right now. So that's one thing that puts poetry in a very, very good place right now, the inclusion of so many voices.
Who are some of your favorite poets?
I got to say, my wife, Leslie Rose, she's amazing. My friend, Desiree Dalla Giacomo, Danez Smith, Hanif Abdur-Rakib, Franny Choi. There's a lot. And I'll say, let me just say this. The majority of my favorite poets are modern era poets, people who were born between like the late 80s to the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, there's so much inclusion in verse, and there's so much that they are talking about right now in their language that was not, it just wasn't a part of an earlier canonization of poetry. And so, I'm a super fan of a lot of the modern day contemporary poets.
You don't have any notes, I don't think, but if you'd like to read something, he's going to his phone here. I mean, you must have thought this was coming, We've got about a minute and a half.
All right, so I can share an excerpt of The American Audit with you real quick. And so The American Audit, what happens is that I have definitions that are used in an audit, and I respond to it with verse. So I'll give you a piece. So one section is called sample. Here's the definition. The audit sample is the random selection of people to interview, activities to observe, documents to review, and records to examine as a representation of the whole management system. I wanted to call on Emmett, but he was not available. Wanted to call Cynthia or Addie Mae, but they too were nowhere to be found, and neither was Trayvon or Little George or Bigger Mike. I wanted to check in with Sandra or Laquan or Philando, but they were all having an out-of-body experience at the time. And Medgar didn't return any of my emails, and Fred didn't text back. The Tulsa folks could not make it to my rally, neither could any neighbors from Rosewood. I wanted to ask unjust victims of 13th Amendment approved convictions if they could speak to me about due process, but they were too busy reenacting slave labor while Wall Street CEOs gorged off excess from white-collar crimes. Everybody I wanted to talk human resources with were not human enough to keep alive or valuable enough to discuss their grievances. They were all just triggers for grief. Somber February facts. Cautionary tales of insubordination. American blackness is hard work. The hours are brutal, as is the supervision. The management is ever-changing, but the mission statement remains the same. Dehumanization keeps the company afloat despite evidence citing just how much it has drowned a culture. American blackness is thankless efforts and slain scapegoats. It is the butler maid, mammy, expected to clean all the crap thrown its way, always working enough overtime to accrue hours to get a break from misery. It has failed evaluations that never result in termination unless its pink slip be signed by a coroner, a neglected labor union where workers' rights are wronged at every turn, the deleted paragraphs of an employee handbook revised every time the organization offers new instruction to reinforce its dogma.
Thank you, Donnie Rose. He'll be at the sold-out Hartley Bay Theater this Friday. Signature Sports for Talk Louisiana comes from Brian Lowe Financial. Stay tuned.